Welcome to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later, where we research the response of our past and review their relevance for today. This is your host, Moshe Kurtz.
Great.
Shalom Aleichem, and welcome to another episode of Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. Today, we are joined by Rabbi Daniel Sayani, and we are going to be talking about whether mikvaos for taharas are a big scam. Rabbi Daniel Sayani has been involved in various aspects of the Chevra Kadisha and Jewish funerals for over 6 years. He has smicha from Machon Leman Yilmadu, which includes musmachim such as Nitei Gavriel and Harav David Shochet Tzitzal, Yeshivas Or Kedoshim de Biala, and from Machon Smicha, and is also a member of the Rabbinical Alliance of America. By pure coincidence, or Hashgacha Pratis, we just had a Rabbi Gil student on, who I think is one of your allies in the alliance. I love the name. I feel like it's like from Star Wars or something. You know, you're like part of the alliance. Great branding on your end. And we are going to be looking at a tshuva of the Yaskel Avdi and contrasting it with the psakim of Rav Moshe Feinstein about whether a mikvah is required. So Rabbi Sayani, maybe you want to, I think it's a little bit obvious from your bio, tell us, you know, why you chose these tshuvos, maybe just familiarize our audience, you know, with, in general, what happens at a tahara, and what is the point of controversy over here we're going to be looking at today?
Fantastic. So, the Chevra Kadisha, the two main functions that we provide are shmira, the act of watching or guarding over the deceased, and of course, tahara, which we'll see in just a second, is a bit of a loaded term. So what the procedure really consists of is three distinct processes, which collectively we refer to as a tahara. The first is rechitza, washing, which is mentioned directly in a Mishnah, right? The Mishnah in Masechet Shabbos, the Chof Nun Aleph Amid Beis, specifically talks about, the practice of washing the deceased. In that instance, that we don't do it on Shabbos, but it does mention that there is a washing of the deceased. And this was done for purposes of Kavod HaMeis, and later sources like the Sefer Chassidim explain that we return somebody to Olam Haba in the same way that they came in, right? A person comes into the world by water clean. They leave the world in the same way. And the Rishonim speak very much at length about this and how it needs to be a thorough process. There's another tshuva of the Binyamin Zev where he says how thoroughly it needs to be done in the way a person prepares themselves in Erev Shabbos to go to shul, because we're preparing the mace for entering into Shabbos or Shabbason, you know, sort of the Sabbath of Sabbaths of their existence, basically. And then the
Yom
component that
Shabbos Menucha.
Yes. And the part of this that we refer to as the Tahara is something that is shrouded in a bit more mystery, in the sense that it doesn't have a direct makor in, you know, in any Torah Shebaal Peh or in any Rishonim, but it is something that emerged in popularity really around the time of the late 16th, early 17th centuries. And there was a book called Mavr Yabok that was published by Mekobel in Italy. And Mavr Yabok is really the first to really put in print this idea that there should be a purification of really more of the metaphysical nature on top of a rechitza, a washing, a cleansing. And that is what we refer to as the tahara itself. And the idea, and the Yaskel Avdi in the tshuva that we're going to see, he sort of explains some of the background of where this came from. But the short answer is that there is a belief, it's brought in the Shiuri Knesset HaGedola, actually, as well as the Tashbates. There's this belief that when the time of Yetzias Neshama occurs, there is a belief that that a Nifter experiences some sort of a Balkari situation, that there is some emission, and this would cause the Neshama embarrassment. And to sort of remove that, take it as literally as you may, but to sort of remove that or remedy that, there is a process of Tahara.
Right. It raised my eyebrow. I was looking at the Lashon that the Yaskel Avi, who you'll tell us who that is in a moment, quotes from Natash Bates. He says, "Lafi kishana shama yotza mehaguf roa pnei hashchina." He sees the face of the divine presence. Umachvas pachet poleta shichva zera, and he has the seminal emission. Umatames aguf, and therefore he's a balkari, as you said, needs to be purified. It's just like this. It's like a very odd. I mean, in general, I think in Hilchos Avelos, as you're pointing out already, many of the practices that we take for granted today don't have an earlier makor. And even for people, well, I guess we'll see, who may be more rationalist in nature or less Kabbalistic, it seems to have become normative practice. And I guess we'll see the Yaskel Avi is going to adopt more of this Kabbalistic approach. And Reb Moshe Feinstein is going to push back with a more, he wasn't technically Lipish, but we'll call him the Lipishic camp. So you want to tell us,
yes,
right. So who is the Yaskel Avi? Because this is, I have to thank you. This is his debut on our podcast. Sorry, not his debut, in literature, but for us, it's his debut.
Right. So, you know, he's a very, the Yaskel Avi, I think, is a very underappreciated Sephardi posek. It is really the only thing we have in the Shaylos and Shuvas, other than Reb Moshe, that deal with this topic of mikvah for tahara.
Oh, wow. Right?
It's sort of a very niche, you know, concern. But, you know, just Kedar Chagdam, a little bit about the Yaskel Avdi. He's from Aram Sova, he's from Aleppo, and his mother was from the Labaton family, so he came into a Rabbanisha family in Syria. The family moved to Yerushalayim in 1895, and you know, as typical for many Syrian Sephardi, you know, Talmidei Chachamim, he advanced not only in Shas and Poskim, but also delved into Nistar, to Kabbalah as well. And, you know, that's really one of the unique things about him, was that he was a tremendous Mekubal, as well as being, you know, a very accomplished Posek. You know, he was Rosh Masifta at Yeshiva Parat Yosef. And then he was also Rosh Hashiva in the Yeshiva Beit El, which was, you know, really one of the great centers of Kabbalah learning in Yerushalayim. And in 1951, he was named to the Beit Din Agadol, the Irurim, the Supreme Beit Din of the Rabbanut. So he had a foothold in both the Rabbanut as well as in the Sephardi part of the Badatz back then, which was quite interesting.
Oh.
And he wrote 8 volumes of Teshuvot, right? There are 8 volumes of Yaskel Avdi. And he wrote many works on Kabbalah as well.
Wow. Sorry, you're finishing his bio.
Yeah, and I was going to say he was Nifter in 1969.
Okay, during Woodstock. one had nothing to do with the other, I'm sure. But but anyway, so what's interesting is, you're right, he's getting these shilos from Tzvas and from Tveria, Tzvas in particular, about the Arizal's mikvah, and people were lining up in droves to, well, I guess they were dead at that point, but their families were lining up in droves to make sure that they could go and be dipped in the mikvah there. And especially given the fact that some of them were very machbid on going to mikvah during their lifetime. And I think he even writes, he says that there are those who specifically moved to Tzfas so that they can use the mikveh there. And ukabal biyadin mikama gadol tzadikim she'achar sharido son la mikveh hayu tovlim ba'atzmam. So I don't know if I read that line correctly, but it sounds like, is he saying what I think he's saying? He's saying, like, after they dipped the tzadikim in there, they then, like, were resuscitated and came back to life briefly so they could go to the mikvah themselves and then die again. I'm not sure if I read that line correctly, but given the fact there's a lot of Kabbalah in here, I think that's what he's saying.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Generally what he's saying. Yes. Yes.
Wow.
This is a very esoteric shuv. If you're into that kind of thing, you know, then the Yaskel Avdi would be right up your alley, because this approach is used with many other things, many other shuvas that he deals with. So we're dealing with a situation where, you know, where in these cities, people definitely had a, you know, men that were alive. And this is really, I think, what the core of the question is. You know, if a man in life is makpid on going to the mikveh, you know, what should we do when they're nifter for their tahara? Now, I think just, you know, a bit of background maybe for the viewers with this. right? The Gemara in Maseches Brachos, Daf Chav Beis Amud Beis, talks about this practice of Tevilas Ezra, right? A man who has a seminal emission, it was a takana from Ezra HaSofer that they need to, that they need to be metahir themselves. And the halacha is that they become pure by Tisha Kavim, 9 Kavim of water, which all of the Svarim on Taharas say that this is the equivalent of 24 Polish quarts of water. And, really a person could stand under a shower, technically. You stand under a shower for a requisite, time period.
Mm-hmm.
And, it becomes effectuated, right? The Tisha Kavim will pour out from just standing under a shower. And we'll see really that is really the older, more established practice when you do a tahara is that you pour these tisha kavim. The practice lamaisa is that it gets poured from no more than 3 buckets in a continuous process. There can't be a hefsek. Now, the core of the issue is people that did more than that, people that sort of wanted to be Marba Kedusha or whatever, who did more than this by actually going in a mikveh, what do we do when they pass? And the practice in Svat actually was, and in Tveria, was that, they would put a nifter in Svat in the mikveh of the Arizal, which were a mayan, they were spring waters. And in Tveria, they would use the Kinneret, it says in the Tshuva. And they had an easy opportunity, it says, to toivel the mesim in these waters. Whereas in Yerushalayim, people that used the mikveh, it says that it was a standard mikveh from rainwater. And they would have to drain the mikveh out after the tahara, which was not efficient because they had water shortages. So the Shoel in this case, Rav Avram Lieb Zilberman, who was the Abbezdin in Sfas, he's asking the Askelavdi really what the source for it is. Why would this be done? Because it was unknown to him why people would have this hakpad in the tahara process. And he's also asking, really, should it be done?
Right. And you mentioned the reason for a balkeri. That's one concern. The other, I think he mentions in Os Beis of his tshuva, he says, so basically, we're going to give him a tevila in this world so he doesn't need to be purged in Gehenna after his passing, which is funny because we assume that after someone dies, there's a lot of assumptions here that, A, we can still do something to benefit them. Okay, there's some makoros, depending, we can ask who can do it. Is it only a child? Other people, great. But that mikvah is going to help. I don't know if are they getting schar when you put tzitzis on them also? What's going on over here?
Yes, that's a great point. So in Os Beis, he actually quotes one of his Kabbalistic drushes, Vayikach Avadyahu, and he says that, this sort of realm in Olam Haba that we would call in an English river of light, they can't toivel when they're there, so we do it here. And this ties in actually, though, to something broader. That's sort of a theme that you see throughout the entire process, which is that there is really a view that what we're doing, in a sense, is helping the neshama. And many of the things that we do to help the neshama are very reminiscent of what we would do. Of course, the rechitz is like what we would do on Erev Shabbos, the way we prepare ourselves to go into Shabbos, by fixing our hair and cutting our nails. Although nowadays we clean under the nails and we have all of that brought in the Binyan Hinsev and the Darche Moshe. That's another source that really deals with this authoritatively. But, there is this idea that the things that the Chevra Kaddish will do for a Nifter, it's like we're really preparing them for their own personal Yom HaDin. He makes mention here that that those who do the Tevila, they would do it in order to save him from from the severe punishment of these immersions in fire that would occur in those levels of Gehenna. And he says that this is according to what certain Hasidim even do. There were even non-Hasidish Gedolim that requested that in their Tahara, they would have, sort of an enactment of the Arba Misos Bezdim. And in the same way, there are many people where on Erev Yom Kippur, they'll take like a garthel in the Dulmalkus and they'll do that reenactment on Erev Yom Kippur, even as a preparation. And of course, the major preparation of Yom Kippur is going in a mikveh, is toiveling in a mikveh. And, you know, the Gaonim even, you know, question, should a bracha be made on such a practice?
Wow.
So, you know, it's something with such chashivas that there even is an idea that maybe it is a bit more than a minhag.
Hey, look, it seems like a fair trade-off to me, you know, like get a dip in the mikveh versus a dip in the flames of Gehenna.
Right.
It seems like a fair trade-off. Yeah. Maybe. So, right. So when you frame it that way, it could be understood why it's not just these obscure mekubalim who are advocating for it, but you can imagine even the hamon am, the average person, when they hear, oh, I could avoid burning in Gehenna if I just get dipped in the mikvah after I die.
Right.
Okay, my state will pay for the extra costs that go into that. But it seems Rav Moshe Feinstein did not buy into this. Do you want to talk about the contrast between Yaskol Avdi and the Igros Moshe?
Sure. So, you know, Reb Moshe is exemplifying really more of, you know, the Litvish approach, we could call it, even though he technically wasn't Litvish. You know, it is more of the Litvish approach, which is more grounded, really not so much in Kabbalistic thinking at all, but more so in really a straightforward read of what Tevilas Ezra is. Now, the interesting thing about that is, you know, we're taking a concept that is very, which many people, of course, would say this is esoteric and metaphysical enough, right? You know, a person is nifter. What could be more tamei than that? But Reb Moshe accepts it as just, this is the minig, this is sort of the widespread minig of the Jewish people that Marvar Yabok sort of introduces. That and again, as we see in the Yaskol Avdi, he cites the Shari Knesset Hagadola, who talks about you know, this fear that the nifter faces and they become a balkari as a process. Now, obviously, many people are nifter where that physically can happen, right? You know, and so the Marvar Yabok sort of makes a low plug between men and women and children and men who physically can't experience that. So it is perhaps to be interpreted, you know, in a lav dafka way. But Reb Moshe really sticks with that approach. And there is a broader tradition that comes before Reb Moshe, which emphasizes that you do tisha kavim. This is what the Gemara says. The Gemara says for a balkari, he becomes tahor by pouring tisha kavim. There's no mention of him needing an actual mikveh, you know, a kosher mikveh for nashim, let's say. The straightforward approach is that Tisha Kavim is sufficient for somebody in that state of being a Balkari. Before Reb Moshe, take the Aruch HaShulchan, for instance. The Aruch HaShulchan, you know, the one sort of area in Yoredeya where this is referred to, you know, the Aruch HaShulchan says clearly, V'shochim alav Tisha Kavim me'umat. And the Chochmas Odom is really the other Achram, Litvish Achram, who deals with this at length, right? In the Chochmas Odom, there is an entire section on Hanhagos Kever Kedisha, Kuntras Matzevos Moshe. He also says that this is the way to do it, that you pour Tisha Kavim, ideally with the Nifter being lifted upright. And there right. are Chevers even nowadays right. that do it in that Litvish way, that they see it as something that our Achronim say, you do it this way, so you do it this way. You don't add on, you know, sort of the extraneous, in their view, things that the Yaskol Avdi was asked about. So right. Reb Moshe...
And if I may, yeah. there was one line yeah. that really just stuck out to me. I'm looking back at my Igros Moshe, I double underline this one. He says, Ki be'etzem b'meisim chafshi, v'lo shayach lov dini tahar b'mikvah achar shemeis. He makes that point that, you know, you and I were probably raising our eyebrows when we read the Yaskol Avdi, which is right. they're already dead. There's nothing more you can do for them. You're going to say that there's this minhag of Tisha Kavin, so maybe you should make a Kavah Chomer. So he says that Ve'ein lamdim mitisha kavin, shekol shekain b'mikvah adif, because you would think, if nine kavin helps him, kol shekain, certainly if I dip him in the mikvah, this isn't halacha. This is Kabbalah. We don't know the reason for nine kavim, but we have a tradition. There are greater people in us who've established it. We follow that tradition, but who are we to start, you know, playing around with that? This isn't like halacha where, you know, simple logic can dictate something.
Yes, simple logic cannot dictate it. You know, he says explicitly, you know, that the musig of kal v'chomer, it's a matter of halacha, and we don't extrapolate, you know, svaras, right? We don't get involved with making svaras with things that come to us in a way that comes from possibly an origin in Kabbalah.
Right. And he says it's hubris. He says, Vaprach Dorza lo adif me doris hakodmim shahayu gedolim vitovim and lo nagubaza. Like, think about all those earlier generations of Gedolim who are not doing this. And we have the hubris to say that we're holier than them. Or I guess you could put it the other way, honestly. If I were to push back, I could say, maybe we're just in such a low madriga, we need the mikveh to get us onto the level of the the Gedolei Rishonim who preceded us. Maybe that's a charitable read of it. I don't know.
So what's very interesting is that Rav Moshe's contemporary, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky Zatzal, he explicitly gave orders that there should not be a mikveh used by his tahara. There's a book written by Rav Moshe Epstein Zatzal, Tahara Manual of Practices. He was a Talmud of Rav Moshe, and there's sort of a lot of Torah Shabbal Peh from Rav Moshe that he puts in this book, and he brings that Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky Zatzal Davka did not want a mikveh to be used. The other interesting thing is that one of the other big svarim that we use in Chevra Kedisha, the Geshe Chachayim, he establishes actually in Eretz Yisrael that the mikveh should be the standard. It's very interesting.
Really?
He holds really like the Askelavdi. He says that, not only is there nothing wrong with the mikveh, but he saw that as preferably what should be used in Eretz Yisrael.
So if you're going to end your fast early by Rav Tukhachinsky standards, the author of Geshe Chachayim, then you also have to get dipped in the mikveh at the end of life. But if you wait a few minutes longer for Rav Moshe, then you could suffice with the Tisha Kavan, right? Is that how it's supposed to play out? I don't know if people do that consistently.
Right. The interesting thing is that in his Zavah, he requested that the Tahara be done in the Litvish way. He wanted a Rav Moshe, Chochmas Adam, Aruch HaShulchan Tahara.
Wow.
He requested that the Tahara be done with the Chevra of standing him upright and pouring Tisha Kavan over him. That was actually, that was his wishes. He didn't. So he establishes a standard of what he feels should be done in Eretz Yisrael. For himself, maybe on some level, he felt that Rav Moshe was, more correct because, in the Shuva, he says explicitly, Rav Moshe, that this idea of using a mikveh, it's not found even in the Mavri Yabok, which is, slightly Kabbalistic. But he says that there's no mention of this in any Rishonim, even in early Achronim, and Rav Moshe is typically not big on, being Samech on other Achronim, but, he's saying here that there's really no textual origin for it, that it all comes from, it all comes from the basis of what we see the Shoal and the Askelavdi referring to.
Definitely.
These sort of ideas. And more so than that, there is I would say that this is one sort of broad methodological concern Rav Moshe has, that, he sees Tahara, not just as a folk religious thing, but it is something that, Rav Moshe views, that this is a serious halachic thing. The idea that a nifter needs to be washed, this has a basis, is going far back as the Mishnah. So he sees it in such a way that there is a kedusha to it, there is a cheshivas to it, and it should be kept as close to that intention of Chazal and the Rishonim as possible.
I think that's an important point that you make, which is Rav Moshe's approach is not coming from a lack of deference to tradition. Rather, it's because he holds our tradition in such high regard. He says, who are we to start innovating things in the last few hundred years? We have to do things based on what Chazal and our earliest authorities tell us. So that's a very important point, which is the halachic and also the theological elements. Though as our session is drawing to a close, I'd be remiss if we didn't touch on what I think is perhaps the most exciting and instructive point of this for the Hamonah, for people like myself, which is the economic and moral point that Rav Moshe makes. So I'd love for you to talk about that.
Sure. So, one of the things that even unlearned Jews are aware of is sort of this idea of a plain pine box, right? Even Jews that aren't so connected yet to the tradition understand the Takana of Rabban Gamliel, right? The Gemara in Maseches Kesubos Daf Ches Amud Aleph, and this is what Rav Moshe brings, right? Rabban Gamliel was misaking that people should be buried simply in plain linen tachrichim, because people in those days very often would get caught up in spending unnecessary money on fancy tachrichim made of silk and different things, and people would abandon their deceased They wouldn't bury their loved ones out of economic concerns. And so from this is a klal in the Gemara that we try to be as sensitive to economic concerns of the chayim of the living as possible. But also, you know, the intention of that takana is that we treat everybody the same in death. And Reb Moshe is very put off by this idea that if a person was so frum that they that the man went to the mikveh every day, he should get a mikveh when he passes. Reb Moshe had a very big problem with that based on this reading of the Gemara, that really every Jew should receive the same tahara, that we don't make differences and tikkunim and enhancements in the tahara process from one Jew to the next. And most chevras, at least, are very careful that every Jew gets the same tahara. And the economic element, you know, this is the basis for why, you know, we do bury people in a simple aron in America and in Chutz Laaretz where we bury in an aron. Simplicity, keeping costs down, is in line with this takana of Rabban Gamliel. And Reb Moshe's concern was that if people start insisting on a mikveh, and he even transliterates the word chapels.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, I love that, right? Chapels, you get chapels to build a mikveh, they're going to raise their costs. And Reb Moshe he's very concerned about that. The chapel in question that he's talking about, by the way, is Parkside on Queens Boulevard.
Oh, wow.
Olive Hashalom, which no longer exists. But
it doesn't even say that in the tshuva. You figured it out on your own.
I know that from Rabbi Zon. I've heard Rabbi Zon say that this is referring to Parkside. Wow. But the concern was that that if, you know, we start insisting that a mikveh be built, a kosher mikveh, it's going to really, you know, boost costs tremendously. And that becomes a problem. It's at odds with this takan of Rabban Gamliel.
Right. So there is this economic and I would say even a moral point that Reb Moshe is making, which is Rabban Gamliel was misaking, right? We're not talking just a minhag from a few hundred years ago in an obscure halachic kabbalistic source. We're going all the way back to Rabban Gamliel himself, who said that everyone should be able to afford a funeral. People shouldn't be flaunting their wealth at it. It's not about affluence. And here we are now trying to make all these hidurim, which, you know, ostensibly looks very religious, but actually now that's going to become the standard. That's going to become the Glock kosher is going to become the standard for everybody now. And then people are going to struggle to afford what they think is the baseline when in fact that's not the truth. And I guess I would just reflect on this. It's almost a shame that this argument would only be made. I'm sure if Moshe would, maybe there is a tshuva I'm not aware of. We could apply this to weddings. We could apply this to living standards in the Jewish community in general. You look at all the we thought and we prayed and we hoped after COVID, people would learn that we don't need all these huge fancy weddings anymore. That you know you have to take out of your 401k to afford to marry off your kid, but I don't think it's lasted. So it's a shame that this argument would only apply to the end of life. It should apply throughout our lives as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the other interesting thing is, you know, the way and not to go on a tangent, the way the funeral business works practically is that you have corporate owned chapels and you have, you know, privately family owned chapels, many of which are owned by frum Jews in Brooklyn and different places. And, you know, we do have many communities where they go to a corporate chapel when you have an alternative owned by a Jewish family or even a non-Jewish family that wants to accommodate Jewish practice. The price is sometimes 50-60% less. Huh. So, you know, I think to have a broader conversation about the economics of end of life or even how we approach simchas within life, that is sort of a broader issue that this alludes to, definitely.
100%. And is there, you know, just anything else that you, you know, it's very, I'm very appreciative, Roseanne, of having you on. I think you're our first expert in terms of, you know, just dealing with taharas and funerals. And I appreciate us getting to diversify our portfolio, talking about Hilchasa, you know, Avelis and Mikvos here. And is there anything else you want our listeners to kind of just know about this industry, as you call it, about, you know, they have big pharma. So sure. I guess we call it big funeral.
Yeah. Yes. So, you know, if there's one thing that became a passion of mine, the way that I got very passionate about this and learning about it was that I was once doing shmir in a funeral home in Monmouth County, New Jersey. I saw two people go into the tahara room to do a tahara, and they were out in 15 minutes. And it was very clear that they really weren't doing the proper thing. So I educated myself. And I learned that, unfortunately, there are many people doing this that are motivated economically And as such, it doesn't get done properly. Baruch Hashem, many communities, Stamford, Westchester, Clifton, all the shuls in Teaneck and Manhattan, different places. We have many chevras that they send for people. They're thorough. They really love what they're doing. They're doing it with Shem Mitzvah.
I'm sure the place you mentioned has improved since then.
And, unfortunately, in many communities, they rely on a paid chevra kaddisha where the job doesn't really get done to that level. And I think people need to be aware, especially Rabbanim, need to be aware of what goes on behind closed scenes. We can't rely on people because they sound frum. You know, we need to see how these things are being done. We need to take it seriously. We take kashrus very seriously, as we should. And my mission is to really get Rabbanim to think seriously about halachic standards in Tahar and Shmira to ensure that things are being done kedas v'din. And we need to really see it, as Reb Moshe did, as a very important halachic issue, not just some minhag that, you know, is disposable or could be done away with. That this is very important, the very important Masorah of Klal Yisrael going all the way back to the days of Rabban Gamliel and even before. So my closing word would be that I want consumers to become aware of the issues, and I especially want Rabbanim of all stripes to know what's going on in their communities, especially out of town in Manhattan, in places like that, where there might be a lack of oversight. And also one concluding point, just to conclude this on a Lamaisa note, right? You know, what do we do Lamaisa, I think, is, you know, on our Shiloh, what we do Lamaisa is a very interesting thing to look at. So what I see typically is that, you know, people like the Ashkenazi community, right, the Syrian community, you know, they just opened up a beautiful chapel in Long Branch in Deal. They have a beautiful mikveh there. So typically, many Sfardim, as well as most Hasidim, will use the mikveh, which makes sense given, you know, the preeminence of Kabbalah in those traditions. Most other chevras, from what I see, do use Tisha Kavim. Although sometimes a mikveh will be used, because sometimes use of a mikveh may be easier than doing it, in a manner that's ma'umud. The bottom line is that we want to do whatever is best for Kavod HaMeis. People will look at it from different sides. What ends up being more respectful to the Meis, right? That could become a very subjective thing, right? Reb Moshe Heinemann, for instance, brought in Tahara Manual of Practices. He holds that a mikveh is not really respectful just because of the mechanics of how it operates. But I think deep down, he also sees it as really not being in line with, you know, the Litvish approach or the, you know, the textual approach of Achronim that we've received. So, you know, my personal preference, if I were to say one, would be Tisha Kavim. I think textually it does have more of a firm basis. I would defer to Reb Moshe Heinemann and Reb Moshe Shita on that. But, you know, Reb Moshe even says that, you know, even concludes one of the tshuvas by saying, you know, if you have a family where they really feel that this is what their father would want, let's say, we don't protest it. We let people do it if it kind of makes them feel right. better. If it makes
he also says, ain't livnos mikvos about the halavayos. You shouldn't go out of your way to make the mikvos, but yes. Someone who's roy for it, yimsu mikva mishikvar asa, find one that was already made, but this shouldn't be the new culture.
It shouldn't be the new culture. And also, in the vast majority of funeral homes, with very few exceptions, if they do say they have a mikveh, it's not a kosher mikveh, it's mayim shuvim, it's like a bathtub, basically. So, you know, let's keep that in mind. Does, you know, if it's not even really a kosher mikveh, it's a mikveh that would be roy for a man to, you know, satisfy tefillas Ezra in, but it could just easily be done by Tisha Kavim, which is the point that Reb Moshe makes.
Absolutely. Well, Rosiani, I really appreciate you bringing your expertise
you.
And also the moral message at the end as a person who's working in the pulpit. You have encouraged me to maybe have a better understanding of these in Yanim, not just outsourcing it. And I think this is the beginning of that discussion. And I think our listeners enjoyed this as well. Thank you so much. Hashem should give you kentin hatzlacha in your very important work that you're doing.
Amen. Thank you so much for having me. Kol Tov.
Kol Tov. Thank you for listening to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. Please make sure to subscribe to get the latest updates. And if you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to rate us and leave a review. Do you have a response to the response that you want to share on the show? please send your letter to the editor to MitchellMKurtz@gmail.com. And God willing, we would love to consider your perspective to be shared on a future episode. This is Moshe Kurtz, and I look forward to reviewing more responses with you next time on Shoot First, Ask Questions Later.